From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. Now, I say that almost every time we get on the air, and I don't want you to think it's a perfunctory statement. We're very grateful for your support and can't express enough our appreciation. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday is the Orthodox Christian Feast of the Transfiguration, and Monday, Hindus observe Raksha Bandhan. At the intersection of religion and politics and government, August 5th marks the fifth anniversary of the bloody massacre at the Oak Creek Sikh Gurdwara that took six innocent lives. The tragedy offered both an inspiring look at the ways Sikhs respond to such murderous violence and an early warning about a resurgent white supremacist movement that has continued to infect our nation at all levels. On Wednesday, Pee Wee Herman inspired senior White House advisor Stephen Miller, chilled the blood of many Americans with his reptilian presentation of a radically un-American immigration reform proposal. Once again, we are seeing just how much power one leader elected by 19% of the U.S. populace has to dismantle the fundamental building blocks of this country that most of us have perhaps naively taken for granted. Meanwhile, leaked drafts of a revised statement of purpose at the U.S. Department of State shockingly no longer included defending democracy around the world. The focus is on American prosperity and security. If this goes through, it will just reinforce the fact that we are just getting smaller and smaller. And the NAACP has issued its first ever travel advisory for one of our own states. A surge in reports on discrimination and racist attacks has led to the respected civil rights organization sounding a warning to its members about Missouri. How sad. How terribly sad. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The president announced on Twitter that there's no chaos at the White House.
I think it's pretty simple. I've said it before. If you want to see chaos, come to my house with three preschoolers. This doesn't hold a candle to that.
The president heads out for a 17-day vacation. Maybe he'll even manage to stay off Twitter. So let's take this opportunity to catch our breath and maybe figure out what is and what is not important from all of the chaos of the past few weeks. I'll talk with political management expert Greg LaBelle.
Corporate leaders push back with a massive campaign of public relations. The most trusted people in America are ministers. And so if we can get ministers to make this case for us, it'll resonate with the public. And that's exactly what they do.
We all know what pride the political religious right is taking in the level of influence it has over this administration. Of course, their need for endless fundraising means there's a monster under every bed, the defeat of which means you've got to send more money and send it now, right now, to an endless list of culture warriors. The present circumstances mandate that we revisit an interview we broadcast in 2015 with Kevin Cruz, author of the invaluable book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. That's right. Today's seemingly unprecedented confluence of religious zealotry and corporate greed is nothing new in the U.S. of A. But first,
this disgusting ban will weaken our military and land that it defends.
Our nation is not safer when we sanction discrimination.
Because of President Trump's announcement, America will be less safe.
The President of the United States this morning announced he is blowing 15,000 holes in our military readiness.
It's undermining, I think, our national defense.
This disgusting action endangers the lives of American service members and makes our country less safe.
The brave, active duty men and women of our armed forces are trained to be ready for a surprise attack at any time. But what about when that attack comes from their own commander-in-chief, acting at the behest of the political religious right and in contradiction to everything science and military experts tell us? I'm talking about the unprovoked and ill-conceived anti-transgender tweet that Donald Trump sent out late last month, the reverberations of which continue to echo despite the unceasing chaos this administration has continued to generate in the days since. And I'm very pleased to have the chance to do that talking in the company of Rabbi Rona Matlow, who describes herself as the only nuclear-qualified transgender rabbi. Now, that ought to get your attention. Rona, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're going to link to your website, rabbirona.us, from stateofbelief.com, so that our listeners can read your entire inspiring story. But would you just quickly summarize your military service, please?
Sure. So I enlisted in the Navy in the nuclear power program in April of 1979. And while going through the nuclear training pipeline as a machinist mate, which is kind of like a plumber for nuclear power plants, I was awarded a Navy ROTC scholarship, went to UCLA, finished my degree in chemistry, was commissioned as an ensign in 1982, and then I was stationed on board USS Hawkeville in Pearl Harbor, then taught at the Nuclear Power School, and then after that, in Department Head School, I was Weapons Officer on USS Capodanno, Radiological Control Assistant on USS Shenandoah, then Decommissioning Main Propulsion Assistant on USS Long Beach. After that, I went to shore duty and served as Head of Network Command and Control Testing at Navy's Operational Test and Evaluation Force in Norfolk. And for my final tour, I was manager of cruise missiles at the Pacific Fleet Headquarters in Pearl Harbor. I retired January of 2001. After that, I completed my graduate education and my seminary training and chaplaincy training. Since then, I came out as a transgender, and I have been working as an advocate, an activist for transgender people, as well as for veterans dealing with combat injuries and post-traumatic stress. And I do a lot of counseling work with veterans and with transgender people. I do a lot of reach out with Facebook, connecting with people and offering them assistance where they need it.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you arrived at wanting to go to seminary and how that transition took place and how the ordination came about.
I started a master's degree in engineering management program and actually had kind of an aha moment that I shouldn't be seeking a career as a weapons system manager, that I should be seeking a more spiritual path. Mm-hmm. And that led me to exploration of myself and ultimately to the decision to pursue rabbinical training. Mm-hmm. And that led to my ordination.
I think there can be no denying that the president's anti-transgender statement was both a political distraction and a gift to his supporters on the extremist political religious right. So it's crucial for us to respond in both a practical and a religious context. Would you comment on the extent to which both individuals' lives and military cohesiveness would be impacted if this directive were to actually go forward?
Absolutely. There are many transgender people currently serving on active duty. One that I know is an Apache helicopter pilot stationed in Korea, and she has currently 19 years of service. If this were enacted, she would be kicked out of service without being able to complete her career and retire, and it would create a hole in her command. Because of this directive, she's been currently taken out of flight status, which means that her unit is not fully mission capable because they don't have all of their pilots available at the moment. When you take a pilot out of service, you're talking about a cost of at least $1 million to train a replacement, and a brand new pilot doesn't have the kind of experience that this warrior has. She has flown untold numbers of combat missions. A new pilot wouldn't have anywhere near the skills or experience that she has. Hmm. I know another Navy officer who's a Supply Corps officer who served in submarines and surface ships, served in the Pentagon at the Joint Chiefs, and is currently serving at the Defense Logistics Agency. If he were to be discharged, there would be a huge gap in the processing of logistics in the military. And that would, of course, create ripple effects throughout all branches of service because he works at DOD. There are people such as an intel officer at Joint Base McChord here in Washington, a drill instructor in the Army, an experienced combat operator in the Air Force. These are all folks that are on active duty right now living as transgender troops, and their commands are supportive of them, but their commander-in-chief is not. And for every one of these people, if they were to be discharged, it would create a gap in the unit's readiness and create a problem in terms of replacing them with equally qualified people. And in the end, the president is basing his argument on the cost of transgender care. So currently, DOD does not pay for transgender confirming surgery, which is in the vicinity of $30,000. Mm. They do cover hormone therapy, but they also cover hormone therapy for cisgender military members, and so there is no significant cost incurred in that. But even if they were to cover gender surgery, the total cost to the military might be $50,000 per person, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. But when you compare that to the cost of training a pilot like the Hilo pilot that I mentioned, or somebody like myself who was a nuclear power operator, or Kristen Beck, who was a senior chief Navy SEAL who operated at Teams 1, 5, and the Warfare Development Group, or Team 6, and had multiple combat tours during her career. These are people who went through extremely costly training, and if they were summarily discharged by being transgender, it would create huge holes in our operational readiness. Mm. Now, of course, we pray for peace. We pray for the vision of Isaiah that we should beat our swords into plowshares, our spears into pruning hooks. But the reality is that the world is a very dangerous place right now, and we do need our military to keep our country safe.
Sure.
You know, people complain that we're doing social engineering, we're forcing changes down the throats of the military that people in the military don't really want. But when you talk to the average soldier or sailor on the street, they don't care whether somebody is gay or transgender. They just want to make sure that everybody in their unit is doing their job and so that they can fulfill their mission completely and safely and all come home from their deployments and return to their families.
Rona, what does it do to transgender individuals to be so directly called out and shunned, particularly on the spiritual level? What does it do?
It creates a huge sense of betrayal, a sense of loss. Everybody who is on active duty who is transgender right now is going through anticipatory grief right now, and of course they are questioning their own existence. There is a very likely possibility that some of these folks may resort to self-harm because they feel so attacked and triggered by what's going on. And, of course, you know, the National Transgender Discrimination Survey shows that over 40% of adult transgender individuals have attempted suicide at least once in their life, and that's not due to us being mentally ill. It's due to the kinds of stressors that transgender individuals face, like this attack from President Trump.
Yeah.
Switching to religious values, you know, as you mentioned, he is serving himself up on a platter to the so-called religious right, but they are actually in violation of many tenets of religion. So the Torah and the New Testament and the Quran all teach love your neighbor as yourself. I don't think that anybody would want to be called out, targeted, discriminated against, and oppressed the way the president is treating people.
What about the damage to others? And I'm thinking now of both the fellow service members who love and rely on their transgender comrades, as well as people who might feel pressure to take an anti-transgender stand for no reason other than political pressure.
Mm-hmm. So that creates a lot of conflicts among service members. When you are in a military unit, whether it's an aircraft squadron or an Army infantry company or a Navy ship, you develop a tight bond with the people in your unit, and you all feel like brothers and sisters. And just as if somebody were to attack somebody in your family, you would feel very attacked yourself and would want to come up to defend them. It's the same, if not more so, for military brothers and sisters, because we all have each other's back, we support each other, and, you know, so we all feel that betrayal right now. You know, taking away very skilled people from their units leaves holes that other people then have to cover. You also mentioned the political pressure, because there are, particularly in the senior officer ranks, people who feel huge political pressure to go along with these kinds of illegal orders. Mm-hmm. And when you are down the totem pole as a young enlisted person, you are then kind of forced into a climate that you never wanted, where you are being told to follow somebody else's values and somebody else's religious beliefs. And, of course, you know, it's a gross violation of the First Amendment Sure. separation clause for the government to impose religious beliefs on people in the first place.
Rona, why do you think the political religious right has decided to pick a fight with transgender Americans? Hate groups like the Family Research Council have been at the forefront of so-called bathroom bills in a number of states, and now this has escalated to the U.S. military. Why you?
They are seeking any target to have political victories because the right wing is in jeopardy right now. They are learning very quickly that they are having trouble governing, as we've seen with their failure to complete the American Health Care Act. And they're finding that they very well may lose control of the Senate, if not the House, next year during the midterm elections. So they're grasping at straws, trying to reach out for anything that they can do to garner attention and turn the focus away from the corrupt values that they're pushing and try to create scapegoats. Chiefs of police and mayors in Texas came out in opposition to the bathroom bills in Texas, and they pointed out that there's never been a case of a transgender woman attacking somebody in a bathroom, and that, in fact, these kinds of bathroom laws just make people less safe because you would force transgender men into the women's room and transgender women into the men's room. You wouldn't know who's who, and it could lead to a lot of confusion and ultimately to increased attacks on people, including attacks on transgender women in the men's room.
Thankfully, top military leaders have made clear their opposition to any kind of ban. How do you think this is likely to play out going forward?
Well, the commandant of the Coast Guard came out saying that he strongly supports his transgender service members and that he is not going to discharge any active duty Coast Guard members. General Mattis, who is currently Secretary of Defense, has come out and stated that he would not turn back the advances that President Obama and Secretary Carter put in place for LGBT service members. And General Dunsford, the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, another Marine general, has also come out stating that he does not support discharging transgender service members. The rub comes that if the president signs an executive order to carry this out, then these folks, particularly General Dunsford, are in a huge bind, because if they refuse to carry out the order, they can face a general court-martial and face prosecution for treason. General Mattis could actually be recalled to active duty and court-martialed, even though he's serving in a civilian role, because any retired military officer can, in fact, be recalled at the convenience of the military. And, of course, a military court-martial for treason, that would be a far worse prosecution even than what they might face in a civilian court. Right now, they are saying that they are going to continue to support transgender service members, and it's our hope that by enough media attention, enough interviews, enough discussions, enough political pressure, President Trump may be pushed back right off of this stance. But in the end, if he makes this order, then the secretary has the option of either following the order or retiring, and likewise the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
It's very important in the meantime that people impacted by all of this know that there is support and resources available to them, and I want you please to talk about where active duty, reserve, and veteran transgender persons can turn at this particular moment for assistance.
So there are a number of support organizations, including SPARTA, which is an organization for LGBT military members, the Transgender American Veterans Association. There is the Transgender Law Center, which will support any transgender person facing legal action. There is the Trans Lifeline, which is a crisis line in the United States and Canada that operates 24/7 to provide support for any transgender people who are feeling stressed. And, of course, there are people like me. I have hundreds of transgender military personnel that I connect with through Facebook, through Rally Point, which is a military social media site, through Twitter.
What are the marching orders you have for the rest of us, the millions of Americans watching in horror as this absurd story unfolds?
Read my website, rabarona.us. On there, I have addressed in multiple essays as well as in workshops that I presented the true readings of the Bible that show that in fact, it is not only allowed but essentially required for transgender people to live as transgender, because overall we are supposed to live by rules of Bible and not die by them. And our great rabbis have taught that this means that saving lives transcends any requirement in the Bible. So anybody who would say that what we're doing is a perversion of God's will, no, we are living as God created us, and we are not violating any biblical precepts, because the first thing is that we have to live by Bible and not die by it.
Rona, this is so very helpful. Rabbi Rona Matlow is the only nuclear-qualified transgender rabbi. As an uninformed, unthinking president launched an assault on thousands of brave members of our armed forces, Rona has stepped up to offer both counsel and support for those who are most affected and for those of us who are deeply distressed and looking for a way to push back. We'll link to Rona's website, rabbirona.us, from stateofbelief.com. Rona, this has been an immeasurably valuable conversation. I thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to join you today.
As we watch the remarkable spectacle of the American political religious right embrace this presidential administration, and the administration embrace that movement right back, it's particularly jarring to think back to just a year or two ago, when it seemed that diversity, pluralism, and mutual respect were not just taking root, but flowering in this country. Yes, indeed. Elections surely do have consequences. But if we look further back still, this love affair between religion and business, between dogma and power, is clearly nothing new in our country. Whether that means optimistically that we're just witnessing another pendulum swing, or pessimistically that we'll never outgrow this unholy alliance, is for now purely speculation. But an expert on this history is Professor Kevin M. Cruz, who spoke with us in 2015 about this insightful book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America.
I think the broad strokes would be, one, many of the things that we take for granted when we think about America as being either a Christian nation or just a religious nation in general, are in fact fairly recent creations. They don't come to us from the founders. They come from perhaps the generation of our grandparents or our parents. So things like phrases like One Nation Under God or In God We Trust, traditions like the National Day of Prayer or the National Prayer Breakfast and so on. Mm-hmm. A lot of the religious slogans and ceremonies that inflect our national politics and our government, these are creations of really the 1950s. Hmm. And the second takeaway point I would like to make would be that the story that I had traditionally heard about when these things had been created was one that really put them in the framework of the Cold War, that America, in the midst of fighting the godless communists of the Soviet Union, that was when and why we embraced all these religious slogans, international politics. But what I found in the book is that the story actually goes back a little bit further, and it's really, if we're looking at the motivation of the men in the movement who created these trappings of religious nationalism, they were really concerned not about foreign politics in the 1950s, but domestic politics of the 1930s. They were worried not about the Soviet Union, they were fighting the New Deal.
There are other, obviously, seminal turning points in this history that you have written. Would you highlight two or three of the others?
Maybe one before and one after Eisenhower, because Eisenhower really just kind of the pivot point of this story. Mm-hmm. Before him, I tell a story about the ways in which a group of conservative businessmen and sympathetic clergymen advance a language of what they call freedom under God. Mm-hmm. This is really the origin of a lot of the language that takes root in the 50s. But they do so under an ideology of Christian libertarianism. And again, they're targeting the New Deal. Mm-hmm. So this movement really peaks, and it's got ministers. Your listeners have surely heard of them, from Billy Graham, Abraham Verde, but also James Fifield, a Congregationalist minister from L.A. Mm-hmm. And they all work to advance this new sort of religious language that targets the New Deal. And a story I like in the book, this freedom under God ideology, peaks again the year before Eisenhower is elected with a series of 4th of July ceremonies around this theme. And it's a massive coast-to-coast campaign. They've got ministers competing in sermon contests. They have a national radio program organized by Cecil B. DeMille with Jimmy Stewart as the master of ceremonies, and Lionel Barrymore and Gloria Swanson give speeches. So it's this major national event where they get this language out to the public. And a later one, maybe this, I'm drawn to the way in which Nixon tries to follow Eisenhower's example. Eisenhower was very successful at using this religious language, again, I think, to bring Americans together. Nixon is clumsier with it. He uses it to advance his own agenda. So he holds church services inside the White House, with Billy Graham leading several of them, but other hand-picked ministers and hand-picked congregations there to hear them. And also he uses Graham to soften criticism of his war in Vietnam, both through a giant rally at the University of Tennessee after the invasion of Cambodia, and then a massive, to come full circle, a massive 4th of July ceremony in 1970 called Honor America Day, which is, again, it's a rally for the silent majority. So in Nixon's hands, this language of one nation under God that had brought people together in the 50s only winds up driving them apart, because he makes this language something that it becomes an identifier solely of the right. Mm-hmm. And so conservatives rally around it in support of the war, in support of the silent majority. And liberals recoil from it. They retreat from this language that once brought them together.
Kevin, was there a particularly deceptive moment in this history that we should know about?
I think you can look back to that Freedom Under God campaign in 1951, because it gets set up as we're just trying to breathe a religious emphasis back into the celebration of the 4th of July. Let's remember that religious principles were part of us from the founding, and let's celebrate that. That's how they pitched it. Mm-hmm. Behind the scenes, though, they're very clear that this language is not to celebrate the American past, but rather the change of the American future. Hmm. In fact, their ads make this very clear. Their ads run by these utility companies that support this, utility companies that have been fighting the New Deal for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, well, let's make a Declaration of Independence now, in 1951. Mm-hmm. Declare your independence from the federal government. Declare that the government owes you no security, owes you no survival. You should be independent from that.
What motivated this campaign?
The idea that America is a Christian nation is one that goes back to just after the founding generation. So it's sort of been around for a while. This particular application, though, this invocation of that language of freedom under God, mm-hmm. Is one that's used to discredit the New Deal. That's their goal. And they had come to this religious language because their first try at rolling back the New Deal had failed horribly. So big business in the early days of the 1930s is publicly discredited. They're blamed for the Great Crash. The New Deal has started, and with it, it is regulating their businesses strongly for the first time. Most problematically for them, it has empowered labor unions, really, for the first time. So these businesses are catching it from above, from the government, and below, from their own work. Both are kind of pushing back against their authority. So they launch these economic arguments about the merits of free enterprise, and they pour millions of dollars into this. The National Association of Manufacturers, for instance, increases its PR budget 22 times over between 1934 and 1937. They are pouring money at this. The problem is no one's listening.
Do you see the religious right, whether or not they're aware of it, using some of the same techniques that were used in the historical period that you wrote about?
I think to some extent, yes. This general sense of an invention of a religious founding, mm-hmm. I think it's still alive and well. That's something that the people I talk about in the book try to communicate, this constant move to recruit the founders behind this idea that America is a religious nation. Mm-hmm. It takes a bit of imagination, I think. I think if you look at what the founding generation said, they're quite clear on this. Mm-hmm. So these people, much like the religious right today, they often go back to the Declaration of Independence, the invocation of nature's God, or the rights come from our Creator. Mm-hmm. They tend to ignore the Constitution, which purposely keeps religion and the state at arm's length from one another. Mm.
From 2015, that's Dr. Kevin M. Cruz discussing his book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America. A professor of history at Princeton, Dr. Cruz, is currently completing a new book, Divided We Stand, America Since the 1970s, and is working on a new project, tentatively titled The Division, John Doerr, the Justice Department, and the Civil Rights Movement. We'll look forward to those releases. If you spend much time following political news these days, and a growing number of mental health professionals are cautioning against doing too much of that, you're exposed to a lot of headlines touting daily events as unprecedented and almost incomprehensible. You're then exposed to administration spokespersons and apologists spinning those same events as somehow perfectly in line with American history and values. To keep our news compass pointing north, it is essential that we regularly calibrate it with those in the know. And I'm very thankful to be able to call such a person right now in Greg LaBelle. Greg, as always, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, welcome. Thanks to talk with you.
Out of all the chaos, what have been the events that stood out for you in the past couple of weeks as being particularly significant?
I think you have to look at this new round of turnover in the administration, and I would have to say near turnover in the administration, so that we can throw Jeff Sessions in there as well. I've got to use the word bizarre. I was going to use the word unheard of, but I think we could use that about every third sentence as we talk today. You know, with Priebus and Scaramucci and with Spicer, you know, there are rumors now that others are in danger of getting booted or moved around as well. The president is not happy with NSA Director McMaster. There are rumors that they're planning to give him another star, as they say, and send him to Afghanistan, move Pompeo or possibly John Bolton into NSA. And what this is about is about this president's proclivity to work in a state of chaos. And this is the latest iteration, I think, of that need of his to be constantly in a state of chaos.
So is the change going to show us significant progress, or is it basically just going to show us that there's continuation of floundering?
Well, let's talk about the chief of staff, because that's obviously the most significant one, I think, to date. We've got John Kelly. We've got another general in the White House now, and everybody's looking to him to sort of make the trains run on time over there. And as far as I can tell, it ain't going to happen, because as much as he forces everyone in the White House to go through him in communicating with the president, the problem is not primarily with the staff in this sense. The problem is with the president. He's continually going out and saying things that don't make sense, saying things that he hasn't talked with anybody about. So his staff is continually running around trying to sort of patch things up, find explanations for the things he's saying. So unless he can somehow get this president to change the way he functions, this is still not going to work. And I don't think we've seen any indication that this president has any interest in changing the way he functions. So I think it continues. I think it's more of the same.
Well, Greg, how much of this is just a wholesale contempt for the democratic process and for the post-war principles of liberal democracy, both in the United States and around the world?
Oh, on the part of the president,
yes.
A great deal of it. I have often said that it's difficult to respect a president who doesn't respect the presidency. And I think we're sort of saying the same thing here. I don't know if it's contempt or ignorance or such a focus on his own need for approval, approbation, that self-congratulatory nature that sort of comes out looking like contempt. I'm not sure, but it certainly looks and feels like contempt, and the result of these actions certainly leads one to see it that way. But this is not going to change about this guy.
Greg, how much importance do you place on the whole Russian sanctions issue? There's been a strong Russian response to the president finally signing the bill, and I think comprehensive news coverage has been sorely lacking on what all of this could actually lead to.
It's interesting. Apparently, the Kremlin has released a statement belittling President Trump for being played, I think is the term they use, outplayed by the Congress. It's obviously significant because I think it continues to muddy the waters in the relationship between the United States and Russia. What is it? What are the dynamics at play here? What are the parameters at play here? And it all, you know, feeds into that much deeper, much more significant question about Russian involvement in our elections and so on, and our elections and the elections of other countries as well. Until we can sort of unravel that, this is just another sort of piece in this confusing ongoing soap opera that we're watching play out between these two leaders.
I'm appalled at the infiltration of the White House by the fringiest fringe of the political religious right. It really seems that is the only group driving the administration's agenda right now, praying with him, studying the Bible with him, and then screwing the country. What's your take on that?
I'm with you, Welton. I mean, in some ways, I think it gets at what some of us have recognized, if I can be very blunt, as a sort of the rot at the core of this religious political movement that we have seen since its sort of beginnings or return, or however one wants to think of it, in the 1980s. There is this intertwining between religion and politics, which is choking both of them. And many of these leaders, maybe most of these folks, have really lost their credibility to speak as religious leaders in their desire to be perceived as powerful political players as well. There is this core of Trump supporters out there, and a lot of them seem to be some of these evangelical folks. And I don't know what that says. We need to really, I think, spend some time figuring out what that says about what that worldview is that leads these folks to support someone who is in so many ways the antithesis of what at least these folks claim to be their core values as Christians. I do honestly think that many of them are just drunk on power, the access that their positions have given them to show up at various White House events and to be on stages with the President of the United States and so on and so forth, has corrupted many of their views, attitudes, and their attachment to what I assume at some point were their core values. In terms of voters, I think what we see is a continuation of an attempt by political leaders to use religious issues, and I'm going to put those in quotes, as a means to keep a certain group of voters in this country sort of connected to them, attached to them, while in other ways, financial jobs, other kinds of things, the government is not doing the things that are in these people's best interest. Why do people continue to sort of buy into this falsehood? I don't know. I don't get it. I don't understand. There's an alienation on the part of some people in this country, and maybe it does go back to those early days when the religious right began to sort of rise up, that there's such a deep level of distrust with government on their part that anything that smacks of not the government, and that's certainly what Donald Trump ran on, they're willing to look the other way on many, many occasions because of that overriding sort of apparent commitment to drain the swamp, as he likes to say.
Well, let's talk about the political opposition. I have to say the statements from Democrats on the Hill have not been at all inspiring. As long as Democrats say in sentences like, we think the better deal will appeal to middle-class families in both red and blue states, they really are not talking in the language of today's voters, not even a little bit. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah. When I heard about this better deal theme, I was thoroughly underwhelmed. For one thing, I'm just, it's a tactical matter. One doesn't, and this is part of Hillary Clinton's problem, I think, in her messaging and in the presidential race. Even her slogan, Stronger Together, actually pointed back to her opponent. And one of the things we know in politics, your message about yourself cannot be pointing back to the person you're running against. And I think a better deal has the same sort of ring to it. Better deal than what? Well, than this guy. That's not enough. It's not enough to tell voters why you're better than that guy. The question is, what are you going to do for them? How can they hang their hats on you? And so tactically, I think there's a problem with the way they're approaching it. And I agree with you on the larger issue, too. There's a reluctance on the part of leadership to take a stand. I've got to say, we've seen more courageous statements coming out of people like Jeff Flake, Senator Flake from Arizona, in his article in Politico last week, than we're seeing from many Democrats. It does seem poll tested. Now, in their defense, electorally, they have a serious challenge. They have a number of Senate seats that are up next year, and many of them are up in states where Donald Trump beat Secretary Clinton handily. So the question becomes, how do you put together a message that keeps your core supporters in place and at the same time appeals to independents? And in many of these states, like Montana and other places, they have to appeal to a certain percentage of disaffected Republicans. So it's a difficult message to put together, but I really don't think anybody is rising to the occasion and striking a chord that can actually connect to voters, and they've got to figure out how to do that.
Greg, I don't mind confessing, I'm desperate for a hopeful sign in the weeks ahead, and I want to know, what would you consider to be a hopeful sign? What are you hoping to see happen in the midst of all this chaos?
I guess at the legislative level, I would like to see the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate become more proactive in some of the discussions that are going to be coming up. I think that that has to happen. In the case of the president, I think we are beginning to see or hear rumblings of Republicans in the House and Senate complaining about the president and how he's doing more damage than good in trying to get things done. That changes the dynamic tremendously, as these folks, many of whom got behind him holding their noses, we have to remember, last year. And so that begins to change the dynamic. I would love to see the new chief of staff be able to exert some control over the White House, because none of this is good for us as a country. When we look at the international scene, this chaos is not helping us take care of our interests and the interests of our allies around the world. So some ability to, I think, rein this guy in and get him to focus on a sort of a broader issue than his brand is critical. But as I said, I think for the Democrats, I think it's time to stand up and start showing some real serious courage and talking about these issues, how we need to approach these as a united country.
Greg LaBelle is the retired assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, where he ran the semester in Washington politics and Native American political leadership programs. Greg is also a veteran of several presidential campaigns. Greg, as always, your insights are invaluable, and I really appreciate you being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Weldon. I appreciate it, too. I look forward to talking with you again.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. We're always grateful for our producer, Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.